I'm Joe Bendosky.
And I'm Jay Washburn.
And this is Start Writing.
Our guest today is Susanna Rowntree. And I'll just read her bio. When Susanna Rowntree isn't traveling the world to help out friends in need, she lives in a big house in rural Australia with her awesome family, trying to beat her previous number of books read in a year record. She blogs the results at vintagenovels.com and writes historical fantasy fiction, including Pendragon's Heir and the Fairy Tales Retold novella series.
All right, thanks for listening. If you want to write to us, you can reach us at pleasestartwriting@gmail.com. If you enjoyed the show and you want to support us, go ahead and check out one of Travis's books. And as always, we would love if you would leave us a rating on whatever platform you listen to, particularly iTunes. We are hurting for ratings on iTunes. So hit that up. If you want to see the show notes or check out any of the blog posts related to this or any of the other things we've done, you can see those at josephbendosky.com. As of today, I have shut down startwriting.com.
So I think I'll throw in this pitch real fast. I mentioned my novel Song of Locke during the dialogue, and if you go to freelock.jwashburn.com, that's L-O-C-K-E and just the letter J for my first name, freelock.jwashburn.com, you can get the first half for free.
So, as before, I said we would do a marketing minute. So last week we talked about networking with other authors and kind of doing an audience share and using Twitter to do that. If you're familiar with BookBub and the Fussy Librarian, what these are essentially you sign up with these two organizations and they send you an email of books that have gone on sale on Amazon and other platforms. And you fill out what genres you want to get. And so when you get books in those genres, I scan for anything I want to read, but what you also want to look for is someone writing in your genre, because now not only is this person writing in your genre and a potential author you can contact and try and network, this is someone who is taking a very active role in trying to build their audience. So some of the authors you meet on Twitter, like Twitter's kind of all they do. But when you encounter an author who has something in BookBub or Fussy Librarian, this is someone who is taking the marketing aspect of the business very seriously and working really hard. Again, I always recommend, you want to find somebody where there's a mutual respect and interest in their writing. So when you tell people, go read this book, it's genuine because you really like the book. Mm. And thanks for listening.
Susanna, welcome to the show.
Hi, Jay. Good to be on here.
Let's begin by telling our listeners a bit about one of your books. Why don't you pitch us the premise of Pendragon's Heir?
Okay. So Pendragon's Heir, it's about a young lady in 1900 England who discovers that she is the daughter of Guinevere from Arthurian legend, and it's not quite as obvious who her father is, obviously, with the Guinevere-Lancelot Arthur love triangle.
That's so great.
that becomes her mission to find out who she is.
Excellent. Who would you say is the target audience for your book?
Pretty much a young adult audience, although it's got a bit of crossover.
Like for an older audience, like what aspects would be good for a more mature audience?
A librarian who read it told me that she really appreciated the older characters.
Huh.
Yeah.
So as I was reading through it, I felt like the style, it's hard to, I don't know how to say this exactly, but the style felt classic. It seemed like you were mimicking some older works in a really cool way.
I'm glad you liked it.
Oh, yeah. It was excellent. But that tone did make me think that it might fit a more mature audience, like you said. However, the younger protagonist, I think, does make it pretty solidly YA.
Yeah, I think a lot of the young people, particularly in my target audience, who would tend to be sort of more on the homeschooled side of the spectrum. They don't have to be, but they would a lot of being homeschooled myself and sort of writing the kind of thing that I identify with reading. And I just wrote what seemed to come most naturally, I guess.
So isn't the kid, Christopher Paolini, are you familiar with his works?
I haven't read them,
okay.
But I know of him.
I think he's a homeschooler and wrote his first novel as kind of part of his schooling curriculum.
Really?
I think so, yeah. Maybe I'm off, but
oh, I don't know. I don't know. I'm just surprised.
Thought I'd heard. okay, so as another get to know you question, tell us what's a well-known book or author that is similar to your works?
Okay, well, I asked some of my readers that question recently, actually.
Excellent.
And I had a number of responses. One author that a lot of them mentioned was Stephen Lawhead. I don't know if you'd have read his Pendragon Cycle at all.
No.
Okay, so he writes what he calls mythic history.
Okay.
Where he's writing historical fiction with fantasy elements and with an eye to sort of, I guess, philosophical, mythic, religious backdrops behind it.
Yeah. Just that term, mythical history, seems like the perfect label for Pendragon's Heir.
Yeah, it fits pretty well.
Yeah, I like that. Okay, continuing on, the last get-to-know-you question, what books have inspired your imagination the most?
Probably the Bible, really, but also The Lord of the Rings and the Chronicles of Narnia and just anything by the Inklings and people in that circle.
This is excellent. tell us more about the Bible as a source of inspiration.
One of the things that I've really come to see in the Bible recently over the last few years of my life is how many fantasy elements it has in it. Like if you read the book of Revelation, it's got dragons.
Yeah.
If you read the King James Version, it's got unicorns.
wait, where's the unicorn?
Most modern translations translate it as the wild ox.
Okay.
But apparently the original word does mean a beast with just one horn.
Wow, that's awesome.
There's a good deal of back and forth, but there are some really interesting things in the Bible. And there's a lot of also metaphor and imagery and typology in there that, for me, is an incredible source of inspiration.
Man, there's a passage in the Old Testament where, like, Elijah or somebody goes to a seer of sorts who tries to communicate with the spirits of the dead. There's kind of this... Man, it's really vague in my mind, but
I can tell. It's really
okay. It's actually it's King Saul. He goes to this spiritualist, this medium in Endor, and asks whether he's going to win the battle the next day.
Yeah, and he wasn't supposed to do that, right? That was kind of circumventing communicating with the Lord, if I remember.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. Huh. We should move on, but real fast, tell us a little about Lord of the Rings and how that has inspired you.
For the longest time, I didn't want to say that The Lord of the Rings had inspired me at all because I just saw it as being too huge a thing to even try to imitate. I don't want to be the person who J.R.R. Tolkien rings up and says, "Who do you think you are?" Right?
Okay.
But rereading it more recently, I think I've just wound up imitating Tolkien in a lot of ways to do with writing style and theme and symbol. Yeah, it's one of those really big formative influences that's almost too big and too formative to really pin down.
Oh, which of the other Inklings are you familiar with?
C.S. Lewis and Charles Williams, mostly.
I've read a little G.K. Chesterton, but I haven't read any Charles Williams. I'll have to look into that. Okay, let's dive into some discussion about writing craft. So let's first talk about your strengths. What's something that you're really good at, and how did you get really good at it?
I'm probably the worst person to answer this question. one of the things a lot of readers mention is my characters, and like often they won't even like the characters, but they'll say, "But I understood them," when I think about how I developed my approach to characterization, I think one of the most important things was what is to me one of the most fascinating things about human characters, whether fictional or real, which is the whole concept of sin and repentance. And
okay.
The way that a good person can become a villain through just letting one little sin get out of control, the way that bad people can find redemption and repentance. See, the line between good and evil goes right through the middle of every person's heart. So no matter whether I'm writing protagonist or whether I'm writing antagonist, I can always ask myself, okay, so how would I justify doing these things?
Yeah. Man, that's
excellent. There's darkness in everybody.
I love that. So if you were trying to help someone that wasn't very good at building these dynamic, rich characters, what one tip would you give them to do more like what you do?
Look in the mirror. think about the darkness inside yourself and how you would justify doing terrible things, and it will help so much.
What is something that you're not as good at, and what are you doing to work on that skill?
I think I find it hard to be innovative. I naturally gravitate towards paying homage to things that have come before and imitating and retelling and doing pastiches. And so I do struggle a bit to be original. The more I learn about my craft, the less reliant I am on just copying what's gone before. And I've also had some really good feedback from some very strict critics that has really helped.
This might be a good time to chat about some of your myths, your myth retellings, or I can't remember how you phrase that, but
mythic history.
Well, you do the novellas. I want to say a myth retold, or am I getting that?
Fairy tale retold.
Oh yeah. Okay. Mm. So you're taking, you go into a fairy tale that a lot of us maybe know, and you innovate it, you recreate it. Tell us more about that process.
Okay, so the first thing I usually do is come up with an idea of what the theme of the fairy tale is and what it has to tell us that is the most important for us to hear today.
Is there a quick example or an easy example you can think of?
Yeah, okay. So for my first fairy tale retelling, which is a retelling of the Beauty and the Beast, the title of that one is The Rakshasa's Bride. The theme that I got from that was one that G.K. Chesterton had pointed out, actually, in Orthodoxy. He said the theme of Beauty and the Beast is that a thing must be loved before it can be lovable.
So you found the perfect theme for this tale, and then how does that then grow into your version?
Well, one of the things that I'm really having fun with in my fairy tale retellings is trying my hand at different historical periods and different genres. So for The Rakshasa's Bride, I came up with the idea of putting this story in a sort of Bollywood version of ancient India.
That's great.
Just because it seemed to go really well with the theme.
Uh-huh.
And so, yeah, I've done one in medieval Byzantium. The one I'm working on right now is in Renaissance Venice. It's been a lot of fun.
There's a quote, Steve Jobs misquoting Picasso said, "Good artists copy and great artists steal." And I feel like when you can pull from a variety of sources, which it sounds like you've got, you know, Chesterton and Bollywood and this fairy tale. I think when it's copying, when you're just looking at one source and mimicking that, but I think when you start pulling from a variety of sources that kind of have been deeply ingrained in who you are, then to me that's innovation and newness.
One hopes, one tries.
So I've noticed you're a self-published author, but I don't see you writing a lot of series, which tends to be kind of the norm approach to that. Is there a specific reason behind that?
My aim is primarily to write the stories that I'm given and to write them well. And making a lot of money off them would be nice, and I definitely do try my best, but that's not sort of the main aim. So primarily I'm trying to tell the best story I can tell and tell it as well as I can. Now, if that does spin into a series, the project I'm working on at the moment, the big project, it's going to have to be a series of novels, probably 9 novels. So I will be working on a series in the future.
Yeah, that's huge.
Yeah. Well, it also sounds like, I mean, with your investment in the novels, it sounds like there's a lot of research into the history. And then having read pieces of Pendragon's Era, it seems like there's also a heavy investment you're making into studying the language of the time period. Because you've got a very formalized style of dialogue in the book. But not only that, but the narrative itself, like one of the words I picked out was you wrote jaunt. And I was like, that just sounds perfect for the time period you're writing in. And so it seems like there's just a lot of investment there to just write the one novel in that time period.
Like, Pendragon's Egg grew out of all the medieval literature that I was just reading for fun. I purposefully did not do a lot of research because I was trying to focus on the ideals that the medievals had rather than on the reality. Now, for this upcoming potentially 9 book series, I've actually been researching that for a bit over 2 years now, and I have been doing the hard yards.
Do you want to? So some authors are somewhat protective of works in progress, and some are not as much. If you feel like it, now would be a great time to tell listeners about your upcoming 9 volume series, if you're interested.
Yeah, sure. There's plenty that I can tell you about that. I do tend to be a little protective, but people like to know, so I'm learning to let go.
Yeah. I don't have a specific direction. Just if you want to give us some hints about just kind of an overview, whatever you feel like telling.
So it's mythic history. It's covering a 200-year period of history. During the Crusades.
Cool.
But I'm not writing so much about the sort of traditional Western perspective on the Crusades, which is of, you know, people who live in France or England packing up and going to the Holy Land, to Palestine, to fight the war and then coming back again. What I'm interested in is the people who stayed out there and built a civilization out there, which I was not aware had happened for a long time. And it was when I found out about it that I got really excited about it, because, I mean, who goes out to the Middle East and starts building cathedrals?
Mm. Wow. And so will this follow a family over those 200 years?
Yeah, correct. So I've got a bit of a log line here that I've written. It goes like this: when a confrontation with a mysterious enemy goes wrong, a native Syrian family from 8th century Palestine are displaced in time and must survive 3 different periods of Crusader history in their quest to reunite their family.
Wow, that's cool. I like it.
I think so.
Yeah, it's good. It's good. So we're going to back up a sec. Joe has a question he wants to ask you about writing craft again.
So I found that, like most writers, we kind of become somewhat word snobs because we study writing so much. So what is something that you see like new writers doing, or just something in prose or storytelling that drives you crazy when you encounter it? Like, you can't finish the book.
Okay, well, this is less about word snobbery and more about story snobbery, I guess. One thing that I find very difficult to deal with is bad world building.
So what's an example of bad world building? I mean, don't give me the specific author, but just something you encountered and it just felt like it was poorly developed.
Okay, so take a fantasy novel where all the nobles live in lavish palaces with no visible means of support. There are no silk manufacturers, no glass blowers, no spice merchants or stonemasons. And sometimes you don't even see the peasants that farm their food. It's like, where are these people getting all this stuff from? Yeah. Where's the industry? Where's the trade? Come on.
Yeah, it's important. What's a ritual that you use to get your writing done? Or like, what's a writing ritual that you have?
I don't have a lot, really. One thing I often find helpful is that before I start writing for the day, I'll go over and I'll read what I wrote the day before, sort of get my head in the right space. That helps.
Okay. Cool. Nice and simple. So not a certain type of music or a certain drink, any of that?
Nope. Not really.
Cool. Just easy to please. Okay, let's talk about publishing. You're an indie author, so let's talk about the editing process. How do you get your works edited? Like, who do you start with? Do you have alpha, beta, gamma readers? What's that process like?
Okay, so it's usually around the second draft. I'll usually write a first draft, and then depending, I might rewrite it completely from scratch, or I might just give it a bit of a brush and a wash. And then I'll send it off to one of my usual beta readers. And I try to pick people who are going to be really picky and difficult to please. Awesome. And I've got a few that I rely on.
And do you just send it to one of them, or do you send it to, say, all three at once?
Usually about two at once.
Okay.
And then depending on whether I think there are problems that really go deep, I may or may not send it through a couple of rounds of beta reading. After that, at the moment I'm trying to get into affording copy editors. When I published Pendragon's Heir, I gave it to my mom and another friend who I knew would be really good on grammar, and I know you're not supposed to do that, but I did.
It just depends on how good they are.
I think we all three managed to do a really good job. I wouldn't recommend it.
Yeah.
But it was what I could afford. And now that I can afford it, I am getting the best copy editing that I can afford.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's great.
So how did you find your current copy editor that you're sending your projects to?
She was just... I just connect up with other authors on Twitter, you know, and one of them was doing editing and she was really good and seemed to have really good training. So just being connected in with other authors and asking them who they used.
And so as far as marketing goes, how do you market your books, find new readers, and what have you found to be effective, and what are some of the things you've tried that just didn't work for you and your genre?
Oh, man, how long do you have?
Well, we edit it, so you can go as long as you want.
Sure. Well, first of all, I have a core of fans, or you might call them super fans, or even they're just friends. And they're people that I've met basically on Twitter and the blogosphere, just chatting about books we love and getting to know each other. And that's where I get some of my most supportive, excited fans from. And one of the things that I try to do is I try to nurture relationships like that, especially with other writers, because I can offer them critiques and help and encouragement a lot.
Do you exchange full-length manuscripts with other authors?
Not so much on an exchange basis, but on you're working on something that sounds interesting, send it over and I'll give it a look and I'll tell you what I think. So I do that a bit.
Twitter limits you to 140 characters. How does that turn into a conversation and a relationship?
Following people over time, they might ask for recommendations for good reads. They might post what they've been writing on their blog lately, and then I can go and comment on that. One thing I did last year was I live tweeted my way through The Lord of the Rings.
Wow. That's awesome.
So what does that look like? Like every chapter you put out a tweet, or like every just you finish a reading session and you put out a tweet? So what does that look like, live tweeting through The Lord of the Rings?
I'd finish a reading session and then I'd go back through the chapter and pick out a couple of things that I noticed that seemed like really cool things or funny things, or if I could make a joke, or if I thought there was something really interesting thematic going on, I'd just put up a few tweets mentioning that.
Mm-hmm. That is such a fun idea. I love it.
It was lots of fun.
So you mentioned your super fans. How does your interaction with them usually go? Is that through email? Is that through comments on your blog? How do you connect usually?
Usually through just all those things, mostly Twitter. I also, a number of them have hosted me to do giveaways and interviews on their blogs. And I've used that as an opportunity to grow my mailing list. Mm. And then when I've got a new release, I can keep them updated by sending out emails on my mailing list. I also use my mailing list to share interesting things from time to time. Not very regularly, probably not as regularly as I should. But for instance, I just sent out one email with a preview of the illustrations that I've prepared for my next paperback novella.
So how many times a month would you say you're shooting an email blast?
Oh, like I said, not as regular as I ought to. So maybe once every 2 or 3 months.
Okay. Wow. And what would your ideal be?
Oh, that's still something that I'm trying to figure out. Mm-hmm. Maybe once a month, maybe once every couple of weeks. I don't know.
Yeah. So I guess you don't mirror the content from your blog in your newsletter. Is that right?
No, I don't.
A quick question. Do you use MailChimp?
Yes, I do.
Yeah. Okay, cool. Let's talk about your cover designs and illustrations and typography.
Sure.
And feel free to do a little bragging because I feel like they're pretty good.
Thanks. So I've actually got a pretty neat story about the Pendragon's Air cover. When I was moving through the publishing process, quite early on, I started thinking about, say, about a year before release date, I started thinking about what I wanted on the cover. And that involved a lot of going through fantasy novels on Goodreads and having a look at what they were, what the pictures were and what the designs were like. Eventually, I decided that what I really wanted was a beautifully executed oil painting of an epic scene on the front of my novel. And so it didn't take me very long to figure, okay, no, I'm not going to be able to have that. I don't have the funds to pay for it. So then I realized, okay, I'm going to have to do it myself. I trust myself to come up with something that, generally speaking, looks good to me. A lot of self-published books don't look good to me, even the ones that have paid somebody to do a quote professional cover. So I thought, well, I know a little bit about typography and I know a little bit about how color works. And so I'll just design a really minimalist cover.
Yeah. Steve Jobs would be proud.
I'm glad to hear it. So I designed a cover, and just as I had put the finishing touches to it and gotten some really good feedback, I got an email from a friend of mine in the US who is a talented painter, an animator, a graphic designer. He's good. Uh-huh. And he's a professional. And he said, "Hey, I heard you're writing a fantasy novel. And I was wondering if you wanted me to paint you a cover."
Wow.
I know, right? And I was I was completely gobsmacked. Sorry, there's another one for you to add to your lexicon.
Yeah, it's awesome. Keep them coming.
So I didn't know what to do because I just finished designing myself a cover that I was really happy with. So I said, "Well, actually, here's what I've already got. What do you think?" And he had a look at it and he said, "No, you're right. This is perfect. This is exactly what you need. Don't change it."
That's awesome.
That's funny.
He did give it a few tweaks just to take it that little extra mile further.
Yeah.
But so that's basically the cover I have. But because he couldn't paint the cover for me, he ended up doing the maps and the illustrations, and he even designed me my own set of drop caps, which was very, very kind of him.
No way. Yeah, the interior looks awesome. There's Thank that you. Cool sword illustration at the beginning. And yeah, beautiful. What about the banner for your blog? Where did that come from? And if it was you, then let's hear the story. If it's just incidental, then we can move on.
No, it wasn't me. No, I got a friend of mine to help me on that.
Oh, and I also was curious, what software tools did you use for your cover?
I use Photoshop. I should probably be using Illustrator, but I haven't managed to learn how to use that yet.
Yeah, cool. No, it looks great. I sent you these questions, and I'm not sure whether I even want to delve into them, but I better give you the chance if you want to. Joseph Campbell, the hero with 1,000 faces. Do you have thoughts or opinions on his work? And
yes.
Okay. Yeah. Let's hear what you think.
Okay. Well, first of all, this is an area that I definitely want to become more informed about.
Okay.
So if it sounds like I'm coming down a little bit heavy on Joseph Campbell, I appreciate that I need to actually look into him a bit more. I do think that he was onto something. Like there are definitely similarities between myths. There's something that underlies there. I think he was right on with that. Where I would disagree with Campbell is about why you see all these similarities. Campbell was working. He was working on Carl Jung's collective subconscious idea.
Yeah,
which is that there's a sort of collective subconscious that humanity has, and this is where all our dreams and legends and myths and stories come from. And we find things powerful and compelling because they come from the collective subconscious. Like archetypes, like kings, gardens, cities,
so, things like that. So how would you rewrite Campbell?
Well, being a Christian, I would say that I would go with the Inklings on this one.
Okay.
There is a true myth, and that is that is the myth of the gospel and the Evangelium, as Tolkien said on Fairy Stories. So I think that is the underlying. I think that is the underlying myth that we're getting all our myths from. Now that said, obviously, what I believe about storytelling is based on what I believe about history and the world. What Joseph Campbell believed about storytelling was also based on what he believed about storytelling and the world. He believed in a collective subconscious. I believe in a true myth. Yeah, I mean, I acknowledge that not everyone is going to see it the same way I do. But what the challenge that I would give to a writer out there is, don't accept somebody else's storytelling model. Don't accept somebody else's myth model. Build your own myth model on what you believe about the way the world works.
That's cool. I like it. So this is somewhat of a selfish question. The idea of Sehnsucht, which is a German word, is a thematic element in my book, Song of Locke. I don't know if you have anything to say about that. If you do, I will tell our listeners what this word even means. If not, we'll just move right along.
I do have an answer. It might run a little long.
Let me give listeners the definition, and I'll ask you to keep it as short as possible.
Okay.
So Sehnsucht is a German noun, which is translated as a longing, a yearning, or a craving. And in a wider sense, it's like when you're intensely missing something. Okay, your turn. What do you think about Sehnsucht?
Well, once again, I'm with Tolkien and Lewis on this one. I think that Tolkien's comments on the concept of joy in On Fairy Tales. Oh, no, sorry. The essay's called On Fairy Stories. I think the concept of joy that Tolkien discusses in that essay is pretty much analogous to what C.S. Lewis talked about when he was talking about Sehnsucht.
Well, tell us what they said on the topic. I don't know.
Oh, sorry.
Thank you.
So Lewis said that when he was reading myths and great stories, he would be assailed by this sense of longing for something beyond the world, something that could not be experienced in the world. And that was an indicator to him in his move from atheism to Christianity. That was an indicator to him that he was made for something beyond the world. In On Fairy Stories, Tolkien talks about the concept of joy, and he links it to another concept that you may or may not have heard of, eucatastrophe.
Yeah.
Eu means good or pleasant, and catastrophe means a sudden turn at the end of a story. Catastrophe is actually a technical plot term discussing the sudden turn that comes at the end of a story, like a twist, if you will. And so Tolkien used the word eucatastrophe to describe the happy twist at the end of a fairy story.
Mm.
Like in Snow White, when the prince finds Snow White and kisses her and she comes back to life. That is eucatastrophe. It's something that you totally don't expect to happen, and yet it happens. Yeah, so I think that whenever you're having eucatastrophe or catastrophe, if it's done well, that's where Sehnsucht arises from. And I think Tolkien's exact words were joy beyond the walls of the world, more poignant than grief.
Hmm.
And I think the most important phrase in that description is beyond the walls of the world. And that's something that came up in C.S. Lewis's discussion of the concept as well.
Yeah. So personally, I feel like in this reality, Sehnsucht is a feeling that I feel when I read really good fantasy. Like it's almost like it reminds me of something. It's like, oh, this is the thing I've been looking for that I can't find. Anyway.
Yeah. So, well, my boil it down into a nutshell, my own personal theory is that it's got to do with divine grace and divine justice reaching into the story world to set things right.
Mm.
And so you can expect that it does have a very powerful sense of homecoming.
That's excellent. Anyway. That's awesome.
My two cents.
You did great keeping it short, too. Thank you very much. Okay, so I have like 12 rapid-fire questions. And if you spend 5 minutes on the first one, then we're only going to do the first one. Let me just fire these and you fire back. So the first one, what is something you love to do that isn't reading or writing?
I love to knit.
Excellent. What's your number of books read in a year record?
I think it's 119 at the moment.
Whoa. Wow, that's intense.
That's awesome. And you're trying to beat that this year, right?
Mm.
What do you say in the debate over ebooks versus paper?
Oh. Get an e-reader so you know what paper books to buy.
Okay, I like it. How did you gain expertise in other languages like Latin, Greek, and Welsh?
Whoever told you that I have expertise in Greek was telling you a fib.
Okay.
The Welsh in Pendragon's Heir was snitched word for word out of the original text of the Mabinogion.
Whoa.
But I have studied Latin for about 7 years, so.
Okay.
Homeschooling.
Yeah, that's awesome. There's a magic wardrobe in Pendragon's Heir. Is that a purposeful allusion to The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe?
Of course. I feel a little guilty about that one.
Okay. There are a lot of Arthurian retellings. How are you standing on the shoulders of those who've gone before, and what new ground are you breaking?
I'm mostly standing on the shoulders of the medieval retellers. There's a little bit of Tennyson, and there's a little bit of Charles Williams in Pendragon's Heir, but I don't really go any more Oh, and Roger Lancelin Green, who was another of the Inklings. Yeah. But I don't really go any later than the Inklings.
That actually leads me to another question. What's the most contemporary book that you love?
The most contemporary book that I love?
Yeah.
We know you don't like The Hunger Games. We saw the blog.
I have a lot of respect for The Hunger Games. It just wasn't as good as Red Rising. Okay. Probably the most recent book that I really, really, really loved was Crimson Bound by Rosamund Hodge. And that's fairly recent, so.
Okay, cool. I don't know it, but I'll look it up. What's your biggest author brag?
C.S. Lewis's stepson, Douglas Gresham, owns a copy of my book.
Whoa! That's sweet! Oh, that's cool.
How do you know?
Because he's the godfather to my best friend's eldest daughter, and she gave him a copy.
That's so cool. Okay, that concludes the interview questions. Tell our listeners where they can go to learn more about you and follow what you do.
Okay, so my blog is probably, it's my online home really, www.vintagenovels.com. If you want to find me on Twitter, I'm Susanna Tweets. That's SusannaTweets, Susanna Tweets. You can find me on Goodreads, but there are actually two Susanna Roundtrees on there. So you'll have to just find the author of Pendragon's Heir.
And to those
listening, if you go to my blog, you'll be, sorry. If you go to my blog, you'll be able to find, links to all those things.
Okay. Excellent. We'll put, these URLs in the show notes. So if you're listening, thanks, you can go there to look it up. Susanna, do you have any final words that you'd like to say?
Oh my goodness.
Maybe that's too vague. Well, do you have any advice or ask to our listeners?
Great art can't be made in just a few odd minutes of the day. So whether it's a novel you're writing or even just a cover you're designing, start early, take the time, take your time, and don't put anything out there until you're really, really ready for it. And that way, you know, you can put something out there that you're really proud about.
That's awesome.
And otherwise, just have fun.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for being our guest today, and we'll be in touch.
Thanks for having me. It's been a blast.
I'm Joe Bendosky.
And I'm Jay Washburn.
And this is Start Writing.
Our guest today is Susanna Roundtree. And I'll just read her bio. When Susanna Roundtree isn't traveling the world to help out friends in need, she lives in a big house in rural Australia with her awesome family, trying to beat her previous number of books read in a year record. She blogs the results at vintagenovels.com and writes historical fantasy fiction, including Pendragon's Heir and the Fairy Tales Retold novella series.
What does she call it? Mythical histories?
Yeah.
Mythic histories. There you go.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks for listening. If you want to write to us, you can reach us at pleasestartwriting@gmail.com. If you enjoyed the show and you want to support us, go ahead and check out one of Travis's books. And as always, we would love if you would leave us a rating on whatever platform you listen to, particularly iTunes. We are hurting for ratings on iTunes. So hit that up. If you want to see the show notes or check out any of the blog posts related to this or any of the other things we've done, you can see those at josephbendosky.com. As of today, I have shut down startwriting.com.
I think I'll throw in this pitch real fast. I mentioned my novel Song of Locke during the dialogue, and if you go to freelock.jwashburn.com, that's L-O-C-K-E and just the letter J for my first name, freelock.jwashburn.com, you can get the first half for free.
As before, I said we would do a marketing minute. So last week we talked about networking with other authors and kind of doing an audience share and using Twitter to do that. If you're familiar with BookBub and the Fussy Librarian, what these are essentially you sign up with these two organizations and they send you an email of books that have gone on sale on Amazon and other platforms. And you fill out what genres you want to get. And so when you get books in those genres, I mean, I scan for anything I want to read. But what you also want to look for is someone writing in your genre. Because now, not only is this person writing in your genre and a potential author you can contact and try and network, this is someone who is taking a very active role in trying to build their audience. So some of the authors you meet on Twitter, like Twitter's kind of all they do. But when you encounter an author who has something in BookBub or Fussy Librarian, this is someone who is taking the marketing aspect of the business very seriously and working really hard. Again, I always recommend, you know, you want to find somebody where there's a mutual respect and interest in their writing. So when you tell people, go read this book, it's genuine because you really like the book. And thanks for listening. All right. Thanks for listening. If you want to write to us, you can reach us at pleasestartwriting@gmail.com. If you enjoyed the show and you want to support us, go ahead and check out one of Travis's books. And as always, we would love if you would leave us a rating on whatever platform you listen to, particularly iTunes. We are hurting for ratings on iTunes. So hit that up. If you want to see the show notes or check out any of the blog posts related to this or any of the other things we've done, you can see those at josephbendosky.com. As of today, I have shut down startwriting.com.
So I think I'll throw in this pitch real fast. I mentioned my novel Song of Locke during the dialogue, and if you go to freelock.jwashburn.com, that's L-O-C-K-E and just the letter J for my first name, freelock.jwashburn.com, you can get the first half for free.
So, as before I said, we would do a marketing minute. So last week we talked about networking with other authors and kind of doing an audience share and using Twitter to do that. If you're familiar with BookBub and the Fussy Librarian, what these are essentially you sign up with these two organizations and they send you an email of books that have gone on sale on Amazon and other platforms. And you fill out what genres you want to get. And so when you get books in those genres, I mean, I scan for anything I want to read, but what you also want to look for is someone writing in your genre, because now not only is this person writing in your genre and a potential author you can contact and try and network, this is someone who is taking a very active role in trying to build their audience. So some of the authors you meet on Twitter, like Twitter's kind of all they do. But when you encounter an author who has something in BookBub or Fussy Librarian, this is someone who is taking the marketing aspect of the business very seriously and working really hard. Again, I always recommend, you know, you want to find somebody where there's a mutual respect and interest in their writing. So when you tell people, go read this book, it's genuine because you really like the book. And thanks for listening.